Welcome to the Zero Pain Philosophy Podcast. I'm Matt, and together with Carl, I founded Zero Pain Philosophy, bringing you the latest pain information to provide the best treatment options to your patients. Welcome to this podcast on the role of CBD in pain. In today's podcast, I briefly review our pain update for those of you that prefer to listen rather than read. We then look at the literature and what this means for us and our pain practice. So thinking about the cannabinoids, the biological effects of cannabinoids are mediated by CB1 and CB2 receptors. These receptors are G protein coupled receptors, and they're located both peripherally and centrally. To date, the psychoactive effect of cannabinoids has really limited their therapeutic benefit, but we now have products at our disposal which are certified to contain no tetrahydrocannabidiol, THC. That's the component that's responsible for the psychoactive effects. It's the cannabidiol CBD component that we're interested in for the analgesic benefit. The CB receptors have endogenous agonists known as the endocannabinoids, which are derivatives of arachidonic acid. These are called AEA and 2AG. AEA is a high affinity partial agonist of CB1 with little CB2 activity, whereas 2AG is a full agonist at both CB receptors with moderate to low affinity. So how do endocannabinoids work? The signaling pathway is retrograde, meaning that the endocannabinoids are produced on the postsynaptic terminal as a result of neuronal activation. Production of 2AG is in response to increased intracellular calcium. The endocannabinoids, AEA and 2AG, are both lipid-soluble, and they readily cross the synaptic cleft to activate CB1 receptors located presynaptically. And when activated, the CB1 receptor is able to inhibit neurotransmitter release by suppressing calcium influx and by inhibiting adenylyl cyclase and cyclic AMP. So where are these receptors located? CB1 receptors are distributed throughout the brain. Receptors are highly concentrated on those presynaptic terminals. They're also found on astrocytes and microglia, and we recognise increasingly the role of astrocytes and microglia in central sensitisation and propagation of chronic pain. In the peripheral nervous system, CB1 receptors are widely expressed in sympathetic nerve terminals, the trigeminal and the dorsal root ganglia, and nerve endings of sensory neurons. CB1 receptors also play a role in cardiac, GI, respiratory, hepatic, and muscle function, in addition to roles in nociception. And they're a key regulator of modulation of GI motility, as well as another number of other GI functions. CB2 receptors have a role in the central nervous system and the peripheral nervous system, and are thought to be important in nociception, drug addiction, and neuroinflammation. So we have widespread location and roles of these cannabinoid receptors, and actually this makes manipulation of the endocannabinoid system quite difficult. And you can see our aim here is to provide a therapeutic effect without generating adverse effects, the kind of holy grail of any drug development. So we've already said that the endocannabinoid system is a key regulator of nociception, and that's our area of interest. The role of the endocannabinoid system in different types of pain is well documented, including pain produced as a result of activation of heat, chemical, and mechanical receptors. So across a broad spectrum of pain types, neuropathic, inflammatory, and cancer pain. And just for a second, let's consider another drug that we are fairly familiar with that has cannabinoid actions, and that drug is paracetamol. We know that paracetamol has a wide variety of mechanisms, and if you read through all of the literature, you come across several papers that say this is how paracetamol works, another paper that says no, this is how paracetamol works. Take home here is paracetamol has a wide variety of mechanisms. And one of those is an anti-hyperalgesic action through its interaction with CB1 receptors. One of the metabolites of paracetamol, called AM404, increases concentration of one of those endocannabinoids, AEA. And it's been shown that in mice with inflammatory pain, paracetamol exerts this anti-hyperalgesic effect, and that that effect is lost in mice with no CB1 receptors. This effect is said to be downstream from prostaglandin-induced inflammation, meaning that it occurs after the prostaglandins are produced, subsequently shown to be a supraspinal effect. When we translate that, it means that paracetamol blocks the effect of those inflammatory mediators at the level of the brain. So it makes sense to use paracetamol alongside other drugs, such as non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, which themselves directly target inflammation. So quite some interesting insights into paracetamol there when we're thinking about cannabinoids. So with regards to CBD, what studies do we have to date, and what does the evidence so far suggest? I think one of the first studies was one in 2018 by Gamble et al. And the objectives of this study were to determine basic oral pharmacokinetics, assess safety and analgesic efficacy of CBD-based oil in dogs with osteoarthritis. Now, the papers I talk about today, if you look on our pain update section of the Zero Pain Philosophy website, you'll find the reference to those papers, and most of them are open access. So the study performed by Gamble et al. First stage was to look at single dose pharmacokinetics, and this was performed with two different doses of CBD enriched oil at doses of 2 mg per kg and 8 mg per kg. The second element of this study was a randomized placebo controlled vet and owner blinded crossover study. So all dogs received CBD oil at 2 mg per kg, and then in the crossover section, those same dogs received a placebo oil. So they received each of those two treatments. Each treatment lasted for 4 weeks. There was then a 2-week washout period, and then the dogs went into the second category, which clearly blinded to the owner and the vet. Baseline veterinary assessment and owner questionnaires were completed before initiating each treatment and at weeks 2 and 4. Hematology, serum chemistry, physical examinations were performed at each visit. The outcome measures used were the canine brief pain inventory, which I think a lot of us are familiar with, and Hudson activity scores, which I'll be honest, I'm less familiar with Hudson activity scores, I don't know about you. So 22 client-owned dogs with clinically and radiographically confirmed evidence of OA were recruited. 16 of these dogs completed the trial and were included in the final analysis. An initial power analysis was performed to assess the number of dogs needed for this study. And when calculated, it was assumed that 14 dogs would be necessary to find differences in outcomes of interest. So this is a really good start. They're actually answering the question, am I recruiting enough dogs based on the information that I have, that any statistical difference that we prove is going to be genuinely significant. So from that first part of the trial, the results on the pharmacokinetic aspect revealed an elimination half-life of 4.2 hours at both doses. Remember, those doses were 2 mg per kg and 8 mg per kg. And there were no observable side effects at either dose. So for the remainder of the study, part 2, they selected 2 mg per kg to be the dose of CBD for the efficacy work. And the results of that second part of the study looking at efficacy, clinically, canine brief pain inventory and Hudson activity scores, showed a significant decrease in pain, an increase in activity with the CBD oil. And when I look at the data, I think the differences in CBPI scores were certainly significant from my eyeballing of that data, with decreases of 5 points for pain and 10 points for interference. And I'm not sure how familiar you are with CBPI, but the first 4 questions are scored out of 10, so we get a total score out of 40. And the second component, looking at the pain interference, so how the pain affects the dog on a day-to-day basis, there are 6 questions there, all scored out of 10, so we get a score out of 60. And when we look at the validation work conducted by Dorothy Brown, we can see that the reductions that they've seen in those pain scores and those interference scores are indeed going to, what we know from the validation of the CBPI, are significant. So veterinary assessment also showed a decrease in pain during the CBD treatment. Now, unsurprisingly for me, there was no decrease in lameness seen. And we do often see this in studies looking at lameness and pain as an outcome measure. And for me, that highlights the importance of using other outcome measures beyond lameness to evaluate the impact of the pain. So if you fast forward to your clinical use of this, you may use CBD in a patient, and if your expectation to the owner is that the dog's lameness is going to be resolved, you may well be disappointed. However, if you look at some of those global scores and incorporate pain scores and pain interference scores and quality of life, as the Canine Brief Pain Inventory does, then you're more likely to see some successful outcome measures there, I would say. Now, in this study, no side effects were reported by the owners. However, serum chemistry did show an increase in alkaline phosphatase during CBD treatment, which was significant compared to the dogs in the placebo group. So, do we have some limitations here in this study? 9 of the 16 dogs in the study were concurrently treated with non-steroidals, 6 with carprofen and 3 with meloxicam. Now, I would say this could be considered a confounding factor, but we recognise that each dog was assessed at baseline and then at 2 and 4 weeks and compared to them to themselves at baseline compared to 2 weeks and at baseline compared to 4 weeks, and then they crossed over into the other group. I think the other argument you could take on that is, if you're trying to recruit dogs into such a study, can you genuinely recruit dogs into an osteoarthritis study where pain is a component of that disease and not provide any analgesia? You could argue it'd be much cleaner to have all of these dogs on non-steroidals and then look at the advantage of adding CBD as an adjunct. And if you've seen our webinar that Ian Self did on CBD, looking at the evidence, Ian was very clear that CBD isn't a standalone treatment. This is a complementary therapy to be used alongside conventional medicine. So to conclude from this study, we understand this is where the 2 mg per kg BID dose was derived from. The authors concluded that this pharmacokinetic and clinical study suggests that 2 mg per kg of CBD twice a day can help increase comfort and activity in dogs with OA. Yes, there were a small number of recruits into this study, but the authors did perform a sample size calculation. So we think, based on their primary outcome measures, that the results do stand up for themselves. Do I personally think that CBD is sufficient as an analgesic, as a sole agent? I would have to agree with Ian here and his view that we should be using these drugs alongside other therapies. So think about that. The second study that I want to look at is a 2020 study published in the journal Animals by Brioschi et al. And this work assessed the effects of pain relief and quality of life in dogs with osteoarthritis. The CBD preparation that they used was an orotransmucosal formulation. There were 21 dogs in this study, and all of those dogs also received gabapentin, amitriptyline, and anti-inflammatories. And this was the first mention of the drugs. They just say anti-inflammatory, so I'm thinking, oh, okay, what does that mean? In 9 of those 21 dogs, in addition to gabapentin, amitriptyline, and anti-inflammatories, those 9 dogs also received that OTM CBD product at a dose of 2 mg per kg. The outcome measures they used was the canine brief pain inventory at baseline, weeks 1, 2, 4, and 12. So a validated outcome measure for dogs with osteoarthritis, so that's a good start. Now from the abstract, we understand that pain severity scores were significantly lower in the CBD group compared to the other dogs until week 4. That's those first 4 questions in the CBPI that I referred to, the scores pain severity. Pain interference scores, so those second 6 questions that looks at the impact of the pain, were lower in the CBD group at these same time points. Okay, so far, so good. Quality of life was scored higher only in week 1. So that's the information that I'm telling you from the abstract. So I would encourage you to go away and read that abstract yourself. Like I say, this is an open access journal, so hop on there now and have a look. But I think we need to look at some detail before we walk away with these conclusions, because they sound incredibly positive. Let's look at the rest of the paper. In their introduction, these authors summarise OA as one of the main causes of chronic pain in dogs due to active inflammation and a maladaptive component due to central sensitisation. They state that management of OA includes treatment with non-steroidals and corticosteroids. They don't clarify the route of administration of the steroids. And personally, I wouldn't include oral steroids here as an option, and would say that the only route we use steroids in OA is intra-articularly, and probably only in our end-stage patients. Correctly, they state that anti-inflammatories do not provide complete pain relief. I'd probably argue that you could say that depends on the stage of arthritis. Certainly in mild to moderate arthritis, we would expect a positive response to anti-inflammatories such as non-steroidals. This statement then leads to a discussion of gabapentin and amitriptyline as adjunct options. Now at this stage for me, there was no mention of NMDA antagonists. And we do have evidence for NMDA antagonists, such as amantadine, in the veterinary literature, whereas there's no real evidence for gabapentin or amitriptyline. We've got a pain update on amitriptyline, so if you want to take a look at that, and we have plenty of information in the pain update section on NMDA antagonists, amantine, memantine, ketamine. And we also have an upcoming webinar by Gwen Covey-Crump looking at the gabapentinoids. So these authors conclude this section by stating that there's no evidence for gabapentin or amitriptyline, but they don't mention amantadine or memantine. So I think there's a bit of a deficiency there that they've disregarded those as options. And if I was designing this study, I would certainly include an NMDA antagonist here. Thinking about the CBD preparation, they state that the OTM route offers the advantage that bioavailability is increased due to the avoidance of a hepatic first-pass effect. In this study, 24 client-owned dogs were included. Inclusion criteria included radiographic evidence of OA, pain on joint examination, and OA-associated signs of joint dysfunction. Dogs receiving analgesics within 4 weeks of the study or surgery were excluded. Now, one of my first major issues with this study is that the anti-inflammatory used was either ferricoxib or prednisolone. And personally, I didn't consider these drugs equivalent in their analgesic efficacy in the treatment of osteoarthritis. And I think you can already see that these authors have introduced a confounding factor into this study of only 24 dogs. They do clarify and state that ferricoxib was used as their first line treatment, but if adverse effects to ferricoxib were seen, then these dogs were switched to prednisolone. I'm not sure how this passed ethics, because I certainly wouldn't switch a dog from a non-steroidal that's had adverse effects to another drug that antagonises prostaglandins. I would have suggested that these dogs were removed from the study at this stage, I guess with only 24 dogs recruited, you can see why they didn't want to exclude dogs, because they're not going to see, they're not going to have enough dogs to demonstrate statistical significance. Now, the study gets more confusing in that they reduce the doses of medications during the study, dropping the firacoxib or prednisolone by 50% in the second week, and then in the third week by 50% for the remainder of the study. Now, why would you do that when this isn't a clinically relevant strategy for osteoarthritis management? Similarly, gabapentin started at 10 mg per kg and then reduced to 5 mg per kg BID. If at any stage during the study the CBPI scores increased in response to those analgesics being lowered, the dose of firacoxib, prednisolone and gabapentin was increased again. Now, to me, this means that some of those dogs would have been in pain for potentially a few days if the CBPI was repeated on a weekly basis. I think you can tell that I don't agree with this reducing drug protocol in the study, and I'm not sure what the authors were trying to achieve. At this point, the authors mentioned the CBD preparation, and again, there's no mention of a placebo solution. So I can only conclude that the dogs in what they refer to as the control group didn't receive a placebo solution. And I think that's a really important omission in this work. Thinking about their outcome measures, their main outcome measure was the CBPI, which we said is validated, but it's validated in English. For this work, it was translated into Italian by the study authors. And if we subject that to scrutiny, we would say that that translated version needs further validation to ensure that some of those wording elements, which are so crucial in these scoring systems, are not lost in translation. They do state that their treatment success classification was a reduction in pain severity score of more than 1 point and pain interference score of more than 2 points. That is consistent with other studies using the CBPI as an outcome measure. If we look at the dogs that were recruited, there were a similar number of dogs classified as having severe OA in each group, so that's good that they did attempt to classify those. They didn't state how they classified those, and for any future study, I'd want to use the Canine Osteoarthritis Staging Tool, the COAST scoring system. The results table, which then shows the drug doses, highlights the range of doses for firacoxib. So let's see what they say about this in the discussion. We've already mentioned the results of the CBPI outcome measure in the abstract. And at this stage, I'm keen to move to the discussion to see if these limitations that I've picked up so far are considered in their discussion. What I think is interesting in this results section is the success rates of the treatment in the control group, which all look pretty low, suggesting that non-steroidals or prednisolone plus gabapentin plus amitriptylin is not actually a great combination for managing osteoarthritis. But how do we really judge that when some dogs received 1.25 to 5 mg per kg of firacoxib SID, quite a range there, 5 to 10 mg per kg of gabapentin BID, and we're not entirely sure that the BID dosing interval is actually effective, and amitriptyline 1 mg per kg SID, which we have very little evidence for. So there's far too much variation for my liking to draw conclusions in 12 dogs. The authors then tried to say that there were no statistically significant differences in the number of dogs receiving firacoxib or prednisolone between groups, but I would suggest that these numbers that they're looking at this stage are too low to apply statistics to answer this question. In 2 out of 7, or 29% of dogs in the CBD group, and 4 out of 9, which is 44% in the control group, OA-related symptoms worsened shortly after firacoxib therapy was reduced to the lowest dose. Why am I not surprised? We already know from the Werner et al. Study from 2011 that this is not a great strategy with meloxicam. So dose reduction with non-steroidals has, as far as I'm concerned, there is no evidence to suggest that you can maintain efficacy. We know you can't maintain efficacy, but there's no evidence to suggest that a lower dose of non-steroidal provides a reduced incidence of adverse effects. So I don't do it. I don't see there's any rationale for trying to reduce our dose of non-steroidals. However, increasing ferricoxib to 50% of the standard dose at this point resulted in a reversal of this worsening. But actually, I'd argue that it takes longer to bring that pain under control. Once we've got breakthrough pain, it's going to then take at least a few days to bring that OA pain under control. And this is too much of a confounding factor. So I think they really messed up their study design by doing this. In the discussion, the combination of gabapentin and amitriptyline is justified according to author experience, which is where I expect to see some mention of the amantadine evidence. And personally, I think that this work proves that the control group were not effectively analgesed. I also don't think that this point has been very well reviewed in the paper. A reviewer should have jumped on that and asked them to classify that. We can't just put statements based on author experience into scientific publications without appraisal of the rest of the literature. You'll see the statement they make. We've already touched on the statement that non-steroidals and corticosteroids are comparable. I completely disagree with this, and they haven't provided a reference to support this. So again, it appears that the reviewer standards in this journal are pretty lax. I said already there's no placebo product used in the dogs in the non-CBD group, which could certainly influence owner opinion. A sample size calculation was performed, which is a positive to this work, and that suggests that 7 dogs per group were required. Now, there were 9 dogs in the CBD group and 12 dogs in the control group that completed the study. But if you've watched the webinar that Andy Bell recorded for us, appraising the evidence in pain management, one of the things I hope will have taken home from that is when we think about sample size calculations, those have to be based on something. And we need to make sure that what we are basing our sample size calculation, there's only one thing we can base that on, and that would be the Canine Brief Pain Inventory in this study. So we need to make sure that when we're thinking about the numbers that completed the study and drawing statistical conclusions, we only do it for that one outcome measure that the sample size calculation was based on. Another element that was interesting is one question they haven't really answered was why was a benefit suggested up to the 4-week time point of CBD, but then not beyond there? Is that dose effective? You can certainly see from the Gamble study, 2 mg/kg BID was the dose they used for oral CBD. This is an OTM preparation. We certainly need further studies to look at that dose efficacy over time. In the discussion, the authors discuss the interaction between COX-2 and cannabinoids, and they suggest a benefit to antagonizing COX-2 alongside CBD use, and then they state that they strongly advise the use of COX-2 inhibiting non-steroidals alongside CBD. Now, given that this wasn't actually a study finding, they shouldn't really be making such statements. They did not examine that in their materials and methods, therefore they shouldn't be making such firm statements in the discussion. Again, an issue of quality of the journal, and a reputable editor would not have allowed inclusion of such an unsubstantiated statement. Interestingly, note how many times the authors use the word could in this paragraph. It's not very scientific, is it? The word could. This could happen. So, they do finally come to why the attempt to reduce drugs. The statement being, the subjects in the CBD group experience a better response to ferricoxib reduction to the lowest dose in comparison to dogs assigned to the control group. Again, not what the study set out to prove, and there are no accompanying statistics. So again, be really careful about the statements that you take away from this paper if they can't be justified by the statistics. So my conclusion from this paper, I think you've probably already got the picture. I would say that there are suggestions of efficacy here. And really, I say that having read the Gamble paper as well. But there are too many deficiencies in this study designed to convince me. So what do we say? As we say with a lot of veterinary analgesic studies, we need further evidence. And we have to hope that the next group of researchers to look at CBD take on board the deficiencies in these previous studies in the design of any future studies. So that's the literature, and there's a little bit of interesting detail there. I think I would say my conclusions are very similar to those of Ian from his webinar, that we need further work. If you haven't seen Ian's webinar, then I'd encourage you to find that in our webinar section. It's a great webinar. Where are we left with prescribing CBD on the cascade? And I make reference to the cascade in the UK. There's no licensed CBD preparation for veterinary use. In the UK, there's a product called Canadol V, which is a THC-free extemporaneous product that has certified batch analysis, so we know that it's THC-free. That's a sublingual or OTM product for dogs. We could technically use Canadol V according to the next rung of the cascade, whereby we don't have a licensed product. There's also a second CBD product available for veterinary use, and that's a CBD-rich hemp nutraceutical product marketed as Elevance, and there is some clinical research to support that use in dogs. Now, this product is slightly different. It contains CBDA as well as CBD, and CBDA is reported to improve absorption when taken orally. So we've looked at the endocannabinoid system. We've looked at the evidence we have so far, and we've looked at the products available. The endocannabinoid system is really interesting. We can see the rationale for the interest in CBD products. If we look at the quality of the studies we have, we can certainly recognize there probably is something there, but we need more information. I'm sure this is going to come over the next few years. The market is certainly heating up with CBD products, but we need to know the exact content of these products. And the more evidence that any researchers can present to us as pain clinicians, the more likely we are to use CBD supplements successfully to reduce pain as much as possible for our patients. Thanks for listening to this podcast. We hope you join us next time.